En mörk oändlig
dimma. Welcome to Views from the World Tree. On this week's show, we share our thoughts on the American Independence Day. And now, on with the show.
On with the show we go.
Yes, I see. Good news, everyone.
So, news. This week, I have been reading Ready Player One, or rather, listening to Ready Player One, just because I don't remember why. I think I had seen like an advertisement or something for the movie, and I was like, you know, that was a good book. I should read that again. And I really like how Will Wheaton narrates it. He did a good job. So if you're listening, Will, good job. Which you're probably not, but.
That is one of my favorite books. I think that's the book that got me into the whole cyberpunk genre.
Yeah.
Definitely a good one.
It's a good nostalgia trip.
Yeah.
And then for watching, my wife discovered a show on Netflix that she started watching, and she paused it, and this was last week. I don't remember when. I was in here doing something. She paused it, and she was like, come here. You need to see this show because you're gonna love it. So she and I binged watched this one together. It's called Snowflake Mountain. It is 8 episodes long. Have you seen anything about this one? Or
so, actually, kind of funny. The day that you posted this in the notes, I was on Facebook, and one of my friends posted on his timeline. He's like, oh my gosh, Snowflake Mountain is actually a fun show. I'm like, Snowflake Mountain, that sounds lame. Just the title. And then when he told me what it was about, I'm like, okay, sounds like Outward Bound for spoiled kids. I'm in it. I want to watch it.
Yeah. So have you seen any of it yet? Or
I'm about halfway through the episodes that are available right now.
Okay. Nice.
They just added another spoiled rich person, to throw a loop in the teamwork that was being built.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Francesca.
That's the one.
So for our listeners out there, this show it's kind of a twist on the like whole Survivor, Naked and Afraid, you know, all of those type shows. What they did is they took, I don't remember how many people, I want to say like 10 people, of just super spoiled young kids. When I say young kids, I mean like college age, you know, early 20s, mid 20s.
Yeah, I'd say 19 to 26 or so.
Yeah. They sent them out. So they told them that they were going to be on a reality show that was at some fancy resort. In reality, they sent them to a wilderness retreat run by these two ex-military guys. And they take away all of their like creature comforts, all of their technology. You know, they're just sleeping in tents on cots, and they have all of these like survival challenges that they have to do. And it's just really entertaining. And if this is your generation, then I apologize. I'm not laughing at your generation specifically, but I kind of am a little bit. So what have you thought about it so far?
I've enjoyed it. Like most reality shows, I think that 90% of it is staged.
Yeah.
But I'm almost envious of this opportunity that they have. They brought in a wilderness expert who showed how to fill dress a deer. I can't remember what else she showed. But they bring in these wilderness experts that just show these things that a lot of people that grew up in the city haven't had a chance to experience. And so not only does it kind of poke fun at a younger generation and kind of get these people out of their comfort zone, I love the skills that's being taught to them and how overcoming challenges together builds teamwork. It's one of the reasons why I believe that nature's got so much healing in it. And so the show, it's not my favorite genre of TV, but I do enjoy the premise and what they're accomplishing.
Yeah, agreed. I'm not a big reality TV guy, but this one is entertaining. And it was tough to watch at first. Like, I wanted to reach through the screen and just slap a couple of the contestants, but having watched through the end of the current season that's out there, like, it really was honestly really cool to watch how the contestants that stuck it out, and just to see the change in them from the beginning to the end, and how at the end they legitimately care about each other and they're helping each other and watching out for each other, and just a total 180 shift from how selfish and entitled they were at the beginning to going out of their way to take care of, you know, the person next to them, take care of their teammate, and just change the mentality into, instead of every man for themselves, they're working together as one big team. It was really cool to see.
Yeah, agreed. All right. I have a confession. I have a favorite contestant.
Fair.
And I don't want to give anything away for people who may want to watch it, but I will just say that there is a young man from England, a little heavier set, seemed to live a very pampered life, that is so flamboyant. He's hilarious. Like, he is my favorite contestant that I have ever seen on any reality show. I don't know why. I just love this kid.
I know who you're talking about. He was a lot of fun to watch. He was one that definitely, ends up, again, without spoiling anything, eventually reaches the point where he really embraces the experience and starts to realize, hey, I can actually learn some things from this and actually enjoy my time out here. So, yeah, he was one of my favorites too.
There you
anyway.
I did. Yeah, great show. Definitely check it out.
So moving on from Snowflake Mountain, just in other news, there has been an announcement for a new expansion for Hearthstone, the video game Hearthstone. This one is called Moida at Castle Nathria, Murder at Castle Nathria. So this one takes characters from the most recent World of Warcraft expansion, specifically this Sire Denathria is kind of this hoity-toity, very proper lordly character, and turns it basically into a murder mystery party at his mansion. So they're trying to find out who killed Sire Denathrius, and it looks like a lot of fun, like Hearthstone tends to be. Definitely, one of those games that you can sink a lot of money into if you're not careful, but also a lot of fun to just play without, just keeping it free to play. So,
nice.
And then the only other thing I have for news this week, here where I live, we hit triple digit temperatures. So we got up to 103 degrees yesterday. I'm told, so this is my first June and July here. We moved in August last year. Told that it's not common to be this hot. I know there was a bit of a heat wave across the country this week, and other parts back east definitely had it worse than us. But it is newsworthy, I suppose. So I've just been working on setting up a drip system for my vegetable garden, kind of in ground, but kind of not. I have the drip tubing sitting on top of the soil, and then I have wood mulch, or I'm going to put wood mulch on top of that, so that the idea is to keep my garden alive, but also save water, save it quite a bit compared to the spray heads, the sprinklers that I'm using right now to water it. So that's what I've been doing. I'm sitting here with mud under my fingernails and all kinds of good stuff.
That does sound like a fun project, though.
Yeah. I just wish I would have done it before the heat wave came.
Yeah. So fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like that's it for me. Busy week.
Yeah. Some more so than others, but.
I guess that brings me on to what I'm reading. And it's kind of funny that you're talking about an uncharacteristic heat wave. Cause I'm reading a book called The End of Nature. It's by Bill. I can't remember his name. I should write these things down. I want to say McInnes or McKillis or a strong Scottish name. He was a op-ed author for the New Yorker, which is a magazine that does a lot of like opinion pieces. Anyway, this book was written in 1989, right before midterm elections kind of thing. And it basically is an essay on current climate models and how, if we don't change what we're doing, what the planet is going to look at like. And I picked it up. It came kind of recommended. I picked it up, and as I was reading it, I started to take notes of what the computer models in the 1980s said that life would be like and how close they were. And it is actually very eerie how close they are with multiple year droughts, uncharacteristic heat waves. Thinking in your neck of the woods, last year, I think there was triple digits for a couple weeks up in the Pacific Northwest as well.
Yeah, just before we moved up here, I think.
And just kind of a look at the uncharacteristic weather patterns that accompany climate change. And it's just interesting to see the science that was based off of findings from the 1950s, rehashed out in the 1960s, rehashed in the 1970s. This essay called The End of Nature, written in the late 80s, early 90s, basically, painting kind of a look at how nature is going to change and then looking at where we are today. And it's kind of scary. Kind of neat that he was right, but scary.
Yeah.
So.
It's always fun and interesting to me when people are able to predict things so accurately. Maybe he talked about this, maybe not, but it makes me curious about what the methodology was that he used to make the predictions. Can we use that methodology today or learn from it or do something to come up with more accurate models?
He didn't make the predictions. It was a scientist from NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. It's here in Colorado. Who made the predictions, and they used computers to create millions of data points all over the globe, and they were taking weather station data and figuring out averages and then looking at expected population growth combined with carbon dioxide use per person on a line of best fit from the Industrial Revolution until the 1980s when they started this model. And basically extrapolating data for millions of individual data points to predict the next 20, 30, 40, 100 years into the future. If things don't change.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the hard part, is predicting what's going to change.
Yeah. So I do find it fascinating, because I'm not the most tech literate person. In fact, my preferred method of reading books is to pick up a book. but to think that 30-ish years ago, we had the computing power to create global scaled models, to predict this is kind of cool to me, in a strange way too.
Yeah, definitely.
So
I think even now, some of the most powerful supercomputers, that's what they're used for, is weather modeling.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, if you study like the theory aspects of computer science, they will tell you that, so there's this whole like subculture and discussions around true random numbers, and how it's very, very difficult to get a computer to actually generate a true random number. And one of the best ways that they've found to do that is to use weather data. So, and like specifically wind currents.
Fascinating.
They make their computer models based on that. So anyway, some more pub trivia for you.
That's neat. That's a cool thing to know. I didn't realize that. I knew that there was a problem with random number generators as they are right now. So, cool. As far as watching, again, I guess I was going on down a little doom and gloom thing over the last week. But I was actually more listening to a podcast, TED Talks Climate. And there was a TED speaker from Denmark that was, his TED talk was basically like, it wasn't titled Why We Should Live Like the Vikings, but it was definitely geared towards living like the Vikings.
Nice.
So the basic premise of his talk was Denmark is one of the pioneers of wind energy. And they showed that wind energy is possible. And then he talked about a little bit about the storage thing. And I guess there's scientists in Denmark right now that are figuring out how to use wind energy to create electrolysis in water to separate the hydrogen from the oxygen, to store the energy as hydrogen gas, to slow release it back into the grid to spin a turbine throughout the night.
Nice.
Basically getting rid of the whole storage thing that we discussed last year sometime when we were talking about alternative forms of energy. So it was a really cool thing. And the reason why he was talking about living like the Vikings, he was talking about longship creation up in Norway and down in Denmark, and he was basically saying that it took just as much time to create and stitch the sail as it did to create the ship. They made sure that every stitch was placed exactly where it needed to be. They made sure that the dimensions was exactly for the purpose of the sail. They had multiple sails for different things, such as going up a river or going transcontinental or just fishing type of thing. And so they, over 500, 600 years, had perfected sail making just as well as they had perfected boat making, creating the perfect sailing community, which is why the Vikings were able to discover Iceland, Greenland, Newfoundland, and they beat Christopher Columbus to the Americas by, 400 years, 500 years?
Yeah, something like that.
So he was basically saying, like, we need to remember that the Vikings knew how to harness the wind energy to to use a resource rather than exploit a resource. And so that was kind of the basic of his TED talk. And I thought that was kind of cool.
Nice. I might have to look that one up. Not just because of the, you know, the whole Vikings thing, but anytime somebody is talking about alternative energy and they specifically bring up the, you know, solutions to the storage problem, those are the ones that I find worth actually listening to. Because anybody can talk about throwing solar panels and windmills around, but until you come up, like we talked about last year, and like you know even better than I do, until you solve the storage problem, it's there's not a whole lot that can be done large scale anyway.
What I like about this guy's idea on the storage problem of using electricity generated from the windmills to create hydrogen gas from water, it gets rid of the need for rare earth metals.
Yeah.
So really it's solving two problems. You're not mining for these alkali metals like we are for car batteries and the hybrid cars and whatnot. It's a new frontier, and it's kind of exciting.
Yeah. The next 10 years should be pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. I guess other news. This last week, we talked a little bit about the midsummer festivities. I had a chance to go up into the mountains of Colorado and join a bunch of other people up in the middle of a small town. And celebrate midsummer. So we, I wasn't there to raise the maypole, but I got to see the decorations, talk to different craft members, talk to some reenactors and actors on Viking lifestyle back in the day, and just kind of meet members of the community that is kind of going down the same path of discovery that I'm going down right now. So it was kind of fun to get together and celebrate midsummer with a group of people.
Yeah, that does sound like a lot of fun. I was jealous seeing the photos and stuff. It looked like a good time.
Yeah. So I know you can't see me through the podcast, but I was mistaken for being an immigrant a couple times with my beard and my long hair. So
nice.
Yeah, and then I talked, and they heard my Midwestern accent, and I went, "Oh no, you're just."
Nice.
So. Cool. So that's my news.
All right. Well, that brings us to the main topic, which this week is, like you said during the intro, all about the history of American Independence Day, which we should probably mention is on the 4th of July, this coming Monday. So tomorrow, if you're listening to this, the day that it comes out.
And don't forget, after Will Smith killed all the aliens, the 4th of July will always be World's Independence Day.
True. Yep. I like it. What is it that, what's his name, says? He's like, from this day, the 4th of July will no longer be remembered as an American holiday. But something, something, we will not go quietly into the night. I don't know the full quote.
I need to rewatch that movie. That was a good scene. One.
Bill Paxton, is that his name?
Oh, geez. Who?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I got to look it up. It's going to bug me. If I don't, it's going to bug me the whole time we're recording, and I'm just not going to be, you know, not going to be paying attention. All right, Bill Pullman. So I had the first name and the first initial of the last name.
Well, that's pretty good.
Bill Pullman, yeah. But All right. So we figured that we would kind of break this up into a couple different sections. We would talk about just kind of the history leading up to the United States of America becoming independent from Great Britain, from England. And then we would just talk about some of our memories and the favorite things we like to do. And then specifically some tips for enjoying the holiday without fireworks, whether that's because you are in an area with a fire ban or you just, if you don't want to light off fireworks for whatever reason. So just a quick timeline. We'll try not to spend too much time on this, but it is helpful to understand kind of the events leading up to this. So we start in the year 1754 going through 1763 in a war called the French and Indian War. So the Treaty of Paris ended the French and Indian War, which was the American phase of a worldwide 9-year war fought between France and Great Britain. This was called the 7 Years' War over in Europe. And as a result of this, France ceded all of its North American holdings east of the Mississippi River to Britain. And it was in large part the cost of this war which contributed to the British government's decision to impose a whole bunch of new taxes on the American colonies, which we will talk about now.
In 1765, the British government enacted something called the Stamp Act. If you have ever bought a deck of playing cards, cigarettes, alcohol, or anything else here in America, we still have stamps. It is a form of tax. Basically, you pay for the stamp, saying it's a legitimate good. Like the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act was imposed to provide increased revenue to meet the cost of defending the British Empire. It was the first British parliamentary attempt to raise revenue through direct taxation on a wide variety of transactions over here in the colonies, including legal writs, newspapers, advertisements, ship's bill of lading, anything else, anything that required official bureaucratic approval, got a stamp. This enraged colonists, nullified the Stamp Act through outright refusal to use the stamps, as well as by riots, stamp burning, and intimidation of colonial stamp distributors. That was a tongue twister.
Good job. I like it. So a couple years later, so June and July of 1767, there was a series of 4 acts called the Townshend Acts. These were passed by the British Parliament in an attempt to assert what it considered to be its historic right to hold authority over the colonies through suspension of a representative assembly and through strict provisions for the collection of duties. These acts were resisted everywhere with verbal agitation, physical violence, evasion of duties, renewed non-importation agreements among merchants, as well as acts of hostility toward British enforcement agents, in particular in Boston. And in response, in October of 1768, the British Parliament dispatched 2 regiments of British Army to Boston.
That brings us to March 5th, 1770. The Boston Massacre. So in Boston, a small British Army detachment opened fire and killed 5 people, an incident which became known as the Boston Massacre. These soldiers were charged with murder, given a civilian trial, and John Adams conducted successful defense of these folks.
All right. Moving on then to December of 1773, we have the Boston Tea Party, one of the more well-known timeline points in the American Revolution. The Boston Tea Party was a protest against the tax on tea due to it being another form of taxation without representation, as well as the perceived monopoly of the East India Company. In the Boston Tea Party, a party of Bostonians boarded ships at anchor and dumped some 10,000 pounds worth of tea into the harbor, which became known as the Boston Tea Party.
And one of the reasons why Americans don't drink a lot of tea.
Fair.
Yeah. The following year, or not even the following year, a couple months down the road, March through June in 1774, a series of acts called the Intolerable Acts became law. So in retaliation for the colonial resistance to British rule during the winter of 73-74, the British Parliament enacted four measures that became known as Intolerable Acts. The Boston Port Act, Massachusetts Government Act, Administration of Justice Act, and the Quartering Act. Rather than intimidate Massachusetts and isolating it from other colonies, the oppressive acts became the justification for the convening of the First Continental Congress, later in 1774.
So this was on September 5th, when the First Continental Congress convened. It was called by the Committees of Correspondence in response to the Intolerable Acts, as Steve just explained. It was convened in Philadelphia. At the first conference, 56 delegates represented all of the colonies except Georgia.
March 23rd, 1775, Patrick Henry gave a very famous speech. It's most widely quoted as the "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death" speech. So Patrick Henry, a Virginian councilman, was convinced that war with Great Britain was inevitable. He defended strong resolutions for equipping the Virginia militia to fight against the British in a fiery speech in a Richmond church with these famous words: "I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death."
Just a few weeks later, April 18th to 19th, 1775, we have the famous Paul Revere's Ride, as well as the battles of Lexington and Concord. So on the night of April 18th, 1775, Paul Revere rode from Charleston to Lexington, both cities in Massachusetts, to warn that the British were marching from Boston to seize the colonial armory at Concord. En route, the British force of 700 men was met on Lexington Green by 77 local minutemen and others. It is unclear who fired the first shot, but it sparked a skirmish that left 8 Americans dead. At Concord, the British were met by hundreds of militiamen. Outnumbered and running low on ammunition, the British were forced to retire to Boston. On the return march, American snipers took a deadly toll on the British. Total losses in the battles of Lexington and Concord numbered 273 British and 90 Americans.
June 17th, 1775, the battle for Bunker Hill. Breed's Hill in Charleston was primarily a focus of combat in the misleadingly named Battle of Bunker Hill, which was part of the American siege of British-held Boston. Some 2,300 British troops eventually cleared the hill of the entrenched Americans, but at the cost of more than 40% of the assault force. The battle was a moral victory for America.
January of 1776, Thomas Paine published his famous work, Common Sense. In late 1775, the colonial conflict with the British still looked more like a civil war rather than a war to separate nations. However, the publication of Common Sense, a pamphlet by Thomas Paine, put independence on the agenda. In Paine's 50-page pamphlet, with elegant, direct language, which sold more than 100,000 copies within a few months, more than any other single publication, Common Sense paved the way for the Declaration of Independence.
Which occurred on July 4th, 1776. So after Congress recommended that the colonies form their own governments, the Declaration of Independence was written by Thomas Jefferson and revised in committee. On July 2nd, the Congress voted for independence. On July 4th, it was adopted, and the Declaration of Independence was sent to Great Britain.
Later that year, on September 22nd, Nathan Hale was executed. On September 21st, having penetrated the British lines on Long Island to obtain information, American Captain Nathan Hale was captured by the British. He was hanged without trial the very next day. Before his death, Hale is attributed to saying the words, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country."
This brings us to one of the most famous paintings in the American collection of paintings. Washington crosses the Delaware. This event took place on December 25th through the 26th in 76. Having been forced to abandon New York and driven across New Jersey by the British, George Washington and his Continental Army struck back on Christmas night by stealthily crossing the ice-strewn Delaware River, surprising the Hessian garrison at Trenton at dawn and taking some 900 prisoners. The American triumph at Trenton and in the Battle of Princeton, January 3rd, roused the new country and kept the struggle for independence alive.
And it stayed alive until February 6, 1778, when France and the United States officially formed an alliance. The French had secretly been furnishing financial aid as well as goods to the Americans since 1776, but with the signing in Paris of the Treaty of Amity and Commerce and the Treaty of Alliance, the Franco-American alliance was formalized and France began preparing fleets and armies to enter the fight. It did not formally declare war on Britain until June 1778.
September 1780, Benedict Arnold. Having fought valiantly in a number of battles early in the war, American General Benedict Arnold conspired with the British to surrender the fort at West Point, New York, that he commanded. When John Andre, the British Army officer with whom Arnold had negotiated, was hanged as a spy after he was captured, and the plot was revealed, Arnold took sanctuary with the British.
Almost a year later, in March of 1781, the Articles of Confederation were ratified. The Articles of Confederation was a plan of government organization that served as a bridge between the initial government by the Continental Congress and the federal government provided under the U.S. Constitution of 1787. The Articles of Confederation were written in 1776 to 1777 and adopted by the Congress on November 15, 1777. However, they were not fully ratified by all of the states until March 1, 1781.
September 3rd, 1783, another Treaty of Paris. After the British defeat at Yorktown, the land battles in America largely died out. Fighting continued on the sea, mostly between France and Great Britain, until the Treaty of Paris of 1783. By its terms, Britain recognized America's independence, with generous boundaries, including the Mississippi River on the west. And that is our revolution. Now I've got a Beatles song going through my head.
I have Schoolhouse Rock in my head. Shot heard around the world.
Yeah.
All right, so that's just a quick overview. There's obviously a lot more to go read and research if you're interested, but we didn't want to spend too much time on it. I do think it's, I don't know, obviously I'm very biased here, but I always like an underdog story, and I feel like this is kind of like one of the ultimate underdog stories, at least of you know, things that I can relate to, so... I think it's a pretty cool story.
It is a neat story. I had a history teacher once that kind of talked about the French Indian Wars and how the British colonists had had joined with the Iroquois Nation against France and was taught guerrilla tactics. And one of the reasons why we did as well as we did, especially early in the days, was Britain was still fighting in the honorable face-off across to each other in a field, open field, and take turns shooting at each other until only one side's left, whereas the Americans, soon-to-be Americans, I guess, adopted the Native American tactics of hit and run, firing from the tree line, and basically doing things to make sure that you survived and make the advantage on your side with lesser numbers. And this history teacher always emphasized that if we had not fought in the French Indian War, we may not have ever become independent.
Yeah, that's a good point. If we had stayed with the old phalanx style, at that point it just comes down to numbers, and Britain definitely had more. But if you're listening and you are interested in seeing a only slightly embellished portrayal of both the timeline we've talked about as well as these tactics, I would recommend the movie The Patriot. It's fairly historically accurate.
That's a good one.
It is a good one.
Brought to you by the same actor that so historically portrayed Sir William Wallace in Scotland's Battle for Independence.
Yeah, both great movies.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we should probably move on then so that this doesn't turn into too long. But what are some of your favorite memories of celebrating 4th of July, Independence Day?
There's two. I remember I went to our grandmother's house, 1/4 of July, and there was a rodeo, and we went up on top of this hill by her property and watched the fireworks shot out of the rodeo arena, and I just remember that was so much fun just to hang out with some family that I don't normally get to hang out with over the 4th of July. And then I will always say baseball. Back in the day, my family used to have season tickets to the Colorado Rockies, and they put on one of the most amazing fireworks shows every year. So you get to go, you watch a baseball game, and then they'll bring people out of the outfield down onto the field itself and do a picnic, and they'll launch fireworks from basically where these people used to be sitting, all to music and choreographed with pyrotechnics. It's one of the coolest experiences I've ever been to.
Nice. That does sound like fun.
So, yeah. What about you?
Nothing real specific from growing up. Just, I mean, we did, you know, did fireworks every year, kind of as a, I guess, a neighborhood block sort of. We just do them out in the street, and that was fun. A couple of memorable things though. So I think I've mentioned before on this podcast, I lived in New York City for 2 years. When I was a young man, and for one of the 4th of July's that I was there, our apartment was, fairly downtown, and we were able to see the Brooklyn Bridge. If we went up on top of the roof, and if you know anything about the New York City fireworks show, you know that that's where they do their famous show, though. Launch the fireworks from boats out on the river with the Brooklyn Bridge in the backdrop. So I got to watch that from the roof of our apartment building. And so on looking out towards that, I saw like the professional fireworks show, everything super fancy. And then if we turned around and looked back the other direction, we had a view of the city and kind of like not super affluent areas. And so we were able to see like the different block parties going on with people shooting off fireworks. And it was really cool to see kind of that full spectrum of like, you have the simple and and somewhat impoverished people that are enjoying celebrating the independence of the country and the freedoms that they enjoy, as well as like all the way up to professional fireworks shows out on the river. So it was cool to see just everybody kind of come together for one night and forget about their differences and just celebrate the freedoms that we enjoy. So I'll go with that.
That is always fun. Yeah. My wife and I used to live in a more urban area of Colorado, and we used to sit out on our back balcony. It was always funny after the professional shows ended to see the amateur pyrotechnic displays going on all over the front range. Mm-hmm. As people would launch the illegal fireworks up into the air, and then you'd hear the police going and trying to break them up. And then after the police would leave, they'd go right back up. And it was just funny to kind of watch the cat and mouse of police versus revelers type of thing.
Nice.
So, yeah.
So what are some of your favorite things to do in more recent history? Like, you know, maybe some things that you're doing this year or whatever. Yeah, whatever you want to share.
In the past, I used to love the fireworks. I used to love the big displays and all of that stuff. The older I've gotten, the less I like crowds. And so some of my favorite things to do is I'll get together with just a couple friends, usually barbecue. We'll usually walk up to the local park and watch the fireworks show, maybe go listen to some of the concert or something that's going on in the park, and then sneak out before traffic keeps you stuck in the park until 1, 2, 3 in the morning. So more low-key, a little bit more intimate of a group for celebration, but still fun. So barbecues, sprinklers when they're allowed, and the municipal fireworks show. What about you?
So I kind of similar. I because of various reasons, I haven't really been able to enjoy fireworks for the last 10 or 15 years. Maybe not 15, maybe 10 years. Anyway, so I don't really love that aspect, even though I used to, like, it used to be my favorite thing. Between that and having two dogs, one of which actually does really well with fireworks, but anyway, I also try to find other ways to celebrate. And I used to really love, so when I was first married to my current wife, her family has always been really into parades. And when we were living in Utah, there's just a huge, huge 4th of July parade in Provo. And they would always go and camp out on like the prime spot on the parade route, like right across from the grandstand with the announcers. And they would set up the blankets and chairs, and they would camp out there for like a week sometimes. So it was, that was really fun. I also am not a huge fan of crowds. But I really enjoy like the different festivals and stuff that different cities put on. So where I used to live, I don't even remember what they called it. There's like Steel Days or Strawberry. Every town has their own name for it, right? And just going to that, seeing like the local performers, local artists, you know, crafts, the festival food, all of that has just kind of been really fun to me, because it kind of harkens back to what it was like growing up in a small town. And I think that is kind of the quintessential like American dream type thing. I think that's what, that's part of what I guess I should say makes America great, in my opinion, is just those little grassroots communities that you have everywhere.
Yeah. So, with the droughts and the unseasonably warm weather, most of the people here in America will not be able to celebrate our independence by blowing stuff up. So we wanted to kind of share a little bit of things that you can do to celebrate without fireworks or anything like that. So, and to me, there's really three things that I love. And I mentioned it before, getting together in a barbecue. It's always nice to have people over, fire up some hot dogs, fire up some hamburgers, fire up any of those type of foods, which kind of makes me laugh that the go-to barbecue foods are all named after towns in Germany, Hamburg and Frankfurt. But that's besides the point.
And French fries.
It's normally a warm day, and nothing beats that warmth, like getting together and watching your children or your friends' children, some of the young people in the neighborhood, run through sprinklers. It's a forgotten art, but there is something so fun to see kids running through sprinklers. And I know water restrictions, drought, all of that. Let them run through it on a watering day and just have fun. And then the third thing that I would recommend is I don't know. I guess just two things. I've got two things. Barbecue and like lawn games type of thing.
Yeah. So I can add a couple. Just with the running through the sprinklers, I will mention probably best to let the little kids do it and just watch. A couple of years ago, we were at my in-law's house, and their nephew had one of those slip and slides, the big, like, long plastic thing that you run and slide down. And he was a little bit nervous about doing it. So I attempted to show him how it was done. My dog thought I was trying to play. She tried to, like, jump in front of me. I jumped over her. And long story short, I ended up with a mild concussion. So... Just let the kids play, man. Don't like once you're like mid-20s or above, just yeah, your body will put you in place in your place really quickly.
Yes.
But anyway, so a couple other things that I have heard of people doing is so launching, I'm going to say bottle rockets, but not the firework type. A couple of years ago, we had some pretty strict fire restrictions. And what we did with some of the youngsters was you can do this thing with like PVC pipes and a bicycle pump and a soda bottle, where you put a little bit of water in the soda bottle, you pressurize it with bicycle pump, that's connected with like a little thing of PVC, and in advance you can have the kids decorate the soda bottle with like fins and turn it into like a rocket. So you can still kind of launch rockets, because what you end up doing is you pressurize the bottle and then you pull a string that's tied to a release that like lets it go, and the air pressure with the water sends it really high, like a couple hundred feet up. And that's great fun because you can do it during the day, one. And number two, you're not going to set anything on fire. It also just uses like a tiny bit of water. And then the other thing that I've seen people do is, specifically if you have kids that are wanting to kind of have that firework experience at night, just get a bunch of glow sticks and like send them out in the yard. You can do all kinds of fun games. You can put them in things. You can hang them inside lanterns. You can wear them like on your clothes and your body and just dance around and play night games and stuff. And that kind of, I know it's not the same, but it's pretty close.
I like that. That sounds fun. Yeah. So there's ways to celebrate without actually risking fires or whatnot. I don't know about the rest of the country. I can say that here in Colorado, even though you're not allowed to set off fireworks, most municipalities are cleared by the fire marshal to do small shows. So you can always go do the municipal shows too.
Yeah, I think if I remember living in Utah, even on the worst fire years, the city still had their like official show that was overseen by the fire department. So it's a way to sate your craving, I guess.
There you go. Well, I guess that brings us to the end of our Independence Day extravaganza. Going into the mindfulness moment, I found a quote from our former president, Barack Obama, and he is quoted as saying, "In the face of impossible odds, people who love their country can change it." And I thought this fit with the Independence Day thing, because you would really have to love the colonies to fight a war to gain your independence from Great Britain. I know he meant it more as in the political power, but I do like that this idea that you want the best for the area that you live in. And if you love it enough, you can enact change, however big or small it is. So, yeah. Something to think about.
Yeah, it's very empowering to think about it like that. I don't want to get political, but I have a lot of friends and coworkers that do not live in the United States, and they sometimes are a little understandably confused during this time of year with all of the like national pride that a lot of people have, because on the world stage, the US is seen as kind of a mess sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so there's some confusion, understandably so, about why US citizens have that sense of national pride. And I tried to explain to them kind of what Obama was saying here, which is, I think what he was saying is there's a difference between loving your country and loving like your nation, your government, right? You can have pride in the United States of America and what it stands for and your family and your community without loving how it's being run at any point in history. Like you can separate those things. And if you love it enough, you know, you can change it. The United States is not the same thing as the US government. So, and really that's kind of what Independence Day was about. I mean, the people who left Britain to get away from that kind of stuff, this was basically their idea. They wanted to change things and they felt empowered to do so.
Perfect. I think that sums it up, especially for people who may not understand the love that a lot of Americans feel for this country. So, yeah. That brings us to the end of this episode. In case this love for our country leads to more conflict, you should join us next week as we talk about how to prepare for civil unrest. See you then.
See you next week.